You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Well, good afternoon to you all. I'm delighted that you're able to join us for the launch of our third paper in our Turkey policy paper series, Turkey Goes to the Ballot Box. There are quite a few copies of it available at the entrance. I'm Kemal Kirişçi, the TÜSİAD Senior Fellow at the Center for U.S. and Europe. Today, Ali Çarkoğlu, a very good close friend and colleague of mine, we spent a few years together at Boğaziçi University, the old rubber college where from I retired last year, and at the great pleasure and honor of joining this institution. Ali is currently the Dean of the Administrative Studies School at Koç University. They sit at prime location right at the exit of the Bosphorus Straits into the Black Sea. I suspect and I fear, I hope it doesn't happen, but it could get very hot these days depending on how events unfold in Crimea and the Ukraine. Ali Çarkoğlu is a long student of electoral studies in Turkey. We're very lucky to have him here, and we're also lucky that he was able to put this report. He will be talking to us about 25-30 minutes, and then Michael Reynolds from Princeton University. He teaches at the Near Eastern Studies there. He has had a long interest in contemporary Turkish studies, but is also a historian. I'm looking forward, I should have done it earlier on, reading his book on Shattering Empires, Clash and Collapse of the Ottoman and Russian Empires. Ali has written extensively, of course, many, many academic articles in refereed journals, but most recently, with again a good friend and colleague of ours, they published a book called The Rising Tide of Conservatism in Turkey. Michael will be responding to Ali's presentation for about 8 or 10 minutes, and then we will open the session to questions and answers. I suspect with what is unfolding in Turkey these days, and as we enter into an 18-month-long electoral cycle, I suspect there'll be lots of questions, and I hope that we will have a lively afternoon that will warm us up a bit on an oddly and strangely cold but beautiful day here. I think, Ali, I'll turn the chair, the floor to you, and all we'll right. Take it from there. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here among, again, friends, colleagues, and Turkey specialists. I actually was prepared to make a presentation with PowerPoint, which gives you some comfort in disciplining your talk, but we were late to make the arrangements, so I'll just improvise with the findings that you can find in the report. The details and the graphs are there. Perhaps the first question that we should ask ourselves is our concerns, the reasons why this election is important. I mean, this is, after all, a local election. It is not a general election. It's not going to change anything in the parliament. You might think that, you know, this is just a regular exercise of changing hands in municipalities. Well, it turns out it's not so. Why? For a number of reasons. The most perhaps important of which is linked to the Gezi events in May, late May and June of last year, which again took yet another young life just 2 days ago, the 9th. I should have stopped counting long time ago. 14-year-old kid, and all of a sudden hundreds of thousands of people are back on the streets. That's a clear sign that the Gezi mood, if you will, is still alive and potentially explosive. But to what extent will that be reflected onto the electoral scene is questionable. So we need to evaluate that and see how that plays out. The other, on surface at least, unrelated to Gezi event, the most important development of the last couple of months is the so-called 17th of December process, which is the corruption allegations that were revealed and which basically led to a quote-unquote divorce between the Gülen movement and the AKP. Now that we know that the divorce is basically almost official, we have to be worried about how the movement will be replaced. They had a role to play within the AKP government. They have a group of followers, obviously, quite influential networks for the media and business groups, obviously. This divorce is expected to have some consequences, not only for the elite-level politics, but also for the mass-level politics. A litmus test for the potency of the movement, if you will, to basically strike hard in this game of survival. It looks like both sides see this as a war. As a consequence of this, we have corruption on our agenda. I've been following corruption trends, or not corruption trends, public opinion evaluation of corruption in Turkey for quite some time. For the last 10 years or so, we've done some surveys for TESEV back in 1999-2002 with Fikret Adaman, Burhan Şenatalar. You can access those reports. Back in those days, people were telling us that, you know, corruption is the top four most important issue on the agenda. But this is before the AKP coming to power, towards the end of the collapse of the center-right that brought AKP to power, and that basically ended the traditional center-right-wing politics as we know it. All right? Corruption actually sealed that collapse. But ever since, we've done quite a number of surveys, and the report actually go over those. I think 7 or 8 surveys that I checked, wherein we asked in an open-ended fashion the top two most important problems in Turkey. In no one of these surveys did we ever find any figure higher than 2.4%, which means, statistically speaking, it's zero, because it's within the margin of error. All right? It could be zero, it could be five, we basically don't know. But it's in the margins of public agenda. But the latest figure that I could find was from the spring of last year, before the Gezi events. All right? So we don't know. I would be much more comfortable if I had, again, a comparable piece of data that asked the same question and got the answer for you today. We have a survey on the field, but it's just not yet completed. My hunch is that it will be a little higher than 2.4% this time around, but how much higher? Would it be in the range of, you know, 30%? I doubt it. But that's speculation, so for you to make up your mind. Last thing that we should be worried about is, not the last thing, but not the least important is the economy, obviously. In the aftermath of 17th of December, we've had quite a volatile stock market. Interest rates have been more than doubled overnight on the 25th of January, within 4 or 5 weeks into the crisis. The central bank had to raise the interest rates. Why? Because the foreign investors, or the hot money, I mean, there are economists among us, so they would know this much better than I do. When the Fed also changed its own interest rate policy, the investment money that actually flows into Turkey and the Turkish stock market basically saw it much safer to pull out and sell whatever they had in the market and buy dollars and transfer the money somewhere else. When they buy dollars, obviously, what happens is that the dollar exchange rate increases and the Turkish lira is automatically devalued. Turkish lira lost approximately 20%, which effectively means if you were to make your earnings in Turkish liras and transfer the money in dollars, you basically lost more than 25% of your income. So this is serious economic cost for some segments of the society, but electorally speaking, this is not important. Why? Because we have 53 million voters. Very few of them actually make their earnings in Turkey and make their expenses abroad. So for them, what matters is inflation. For them, what matters is unemployment. And therein, do we see any deterioration in the indicators? The last time I checked, the Turkish Statistical Institute had the consumer inflation, consumer prices rise on a yearly basis, I think around 7.5-8%. By American or by European standards, this is high. But by Turkish standards, it's not that high. However, there are here question marks that I'm going to come back to later on that might have some influence on the way the voters might actually change their minds. Now, obviously, local elections are also important for simply political sequencing of three different elections. We'll have the first one on the 30th of March. We'll have the second one on, I think, August 7th or 10th. And then if the first round doesn't result in the election of the president, 2 weeks later we'll have another round. So by the 20th or so of August, we will know who will the president be. Then the scheduled date for general elections is about 10 months later in June of 2015. So why do we care about all these developments leading to the local elections is primarily because these local elections will set the tone for the next two elections, elections for the presidency and the election for the next parliament. And for all we know, the prime minister is preparing himself for the presidency. And obviously, if the election signals to him that, you know, the presidential election will be an easy race for him, he'll probably come forth as a candidate. If, on the other hand, the local election signal that, you know, he might actually maybe not lose, but he might have to really campaign hard to win the election, he might not want to take the risk, basically. And obviously, all of this gears us up for a local election that serves as a vote of confidence for the government and for the prime minister's charismatic leadership. Is he still a potent, powerful political leader that can pull yet another electoral victory with about 40% of the vote? Anything below 40 will be questionable. I've listened to colleagues and friends this couple of hours ago and yesterday and in other settings. All of us have different ideas about what is the threshold beyond or below which we will say this was a success or it was a failure. Anyways, I'll make my speculation later on. So let me not go over, especially since I'm not helped by the PowerPoint. Let me not go over the graft allegations and the events that followed it. But what's important to keep in mind is the following. What Gulen movement have done is something quite extraordinary. Why? Because the coalition within the AKP government appears to crack, basically. They've already lost 9 MPs, not large enough of a group to form a parliamentary group, for instance. You need 20 MPs for that. Hakan Şükür, I think, was the first one to leave the ship.
Yeah, but you should mention that
Hakan Şükür, I thought, yeah. Maybe you might not know.
He's not an American
he's
football
not,
player.
Yes, but he's a famous Turkish soccer player. Hakan Şükür is Yavaş Yavaş Hakan Hasan Şaş, I think. That's the other one. I mixed it up. That's the podium stress for
you. He's a great soccer player, you can tell.
Okay. So Hakan Şükür and 8 others have left the AKP group. I have to say I'm a little surprised. Why? Because the number of MPs that leave the group actually is a good indicator of what elites expect to happen in the future. If they see the ship sinking down, I think there will be lots of people leaving. The fact that we only had 9 is signal to us that, you know, people are expecting something that the prime minister can pull out of this election. Or at least they give him the benefit of the doubt. And they wait until the 31st of March. If on the 31st we see the general evaluation of the elites and the masses as a failure rather than a success for the incumbent government, then I think you can expect to see more people leaving, more cracks within the AKP. But that's why, again, this election is also important. It's going to determine whether or not the AKP group is going to stay you know, strong and solid together. Okay. So, what are the issues that we should be concerned about in this election? The first issue that I want to attract your attention to is turnout. Political scientists should know a lot about what determines turnout, but I follow the literature. We know almost next to nothing about, you know, why people turn out. We can say a few things in general terms, but the error term in all our explanatory models is quite large. But what we know is this. If people think that the outcome of the election is almost certain, they'll stay home and they'll watch TV, they'll do something else. Okay, the cost of going out and casting your vote will not let you out of the house, basically. You would want to stay home and enjoy the family life or, you know, do something else. If we have a predominant party getting into the election confident to pull out 40-50% of the vote, if you have 40% of the vote, I can assure you that the next runner-up will not have more than 20-25%, all right? So the difference in a first-past-the-post election system, that's the second expectation we have. In proportional representation, it's always valuable to cast your vote because the parties will get their seats in accordance to the percentage of vote that they receive. If you are above 10%, of course, in the Turkish case, you will get a seat and your vote will have an influence on your party's seats. But in a first-past-the-post election system, if your opponent gets one more vote, then he or she wins the election and all of the votes cast for the other candidates are wasted, basically. That's why in a mayoral election, if you think that the winner is already known, and there is no way a serious candidate can challenge that candidate, you would not go out to vote. But the same is true for both the opposition as well as the winners. So, again, the outcome is still uncertain. Will those people who stay home be mostly from the winning party or from the opposition party, because they will both have the same incentives to stay home. So it's important for the political parties to mobilize their supporters to come out and vote. The party that has the organization that can actually knock on from door to door to urge people to get out and cast their votes is more likely to win in the first-past-the-post election. It's more likely to win in any election, but especially in first-past-the-post election, this matters most. And what we know from past research is that kind of mobilizing organizational power simply doesn't exist in the opposition. I mean, the CHP, the MHP, they don't have the organizational networks that would canvass door to door and pull people to the election booth. However, if you notice, the Prime Minister is very frequently making references to the Gulen movement activists who apparently, that's his claim, not mine, going from door to door and campaign against Erdogan and his government. And he says, you know, he actually urges his own people to counteract that campaign, which means Erdogan is very, very much up to this theory of, you know, turnout, and he knows that his organization should come out and mobilize. If he's aware of this, I think he's going to use this, and they will have a good organizational effort to bring their own voters to vote. To cut a long story short, turnout is also important in this particular election context, primarily because what we know from past research everywhere, as well as in Turkey, those who do not vote are more likely to be younger voters rather than older voters. For a number of reasons, younger voters have to work. In the U.S., it's a working day. The elections are on Tuesdays. In Turkey, it's on Sunday. But still, younger people's opportunity costs are higher. All right? So they are more likely to stay home or do something else because they can't afford to go out and vote. Plus, younger people are also known to be alienated from politics, more so than the older generations. Their party identification is not yet solidified. They have not yet voted for the same party over and over for a number of elections. So electoral behavior has not become a habit for the younger generations, and they are mobile. I mean, you are registered in Izmir, but you go to school in Istanbul, so you have to basically jump on a bus or a plane to actually cast your vote, and then you'll say, no, I can't afford it, first. Secondly, I don't have the time, you will say, and stay home. And this keeps the younger voters out of elections. Why is this important? Well, guess what? I mean, if the younger voters are not voting, the Gezi protesters are also not voting. And what type of younger voters will be more likely to vote? Not the Gezi type, but the counter-Gezi type will be more likely to vote. So unless the opposition makes a conscious effort to bring the younger voters to vote, I think AKP has a much larger chance to bring their own younger voters to vote and basically turn this to their advantage. But no matter what, I did a very basic analysis. In local elections, turnout tends to be lower than general elections. And in this election, it could be anywhere between 70% to 85%. All right? The higher it is, the better for the opposition, you might think. But that also depends on what type of younger voters will go out and vote. I mean, I've read quite a number of articles about the Gezi movement, and one important diagnosis that is shared by many is that this is not a protesting group, a group of protesters who are keen on electoral participation. They are mostly alienated. They might protest. They might be engaged in civil society movement. They might be engaged in environmental movements. But tell them to go out and vote, they'll say, oh, that's passé. Vote doesn't change anything. It doesn't count. They are very cynical. And it takes a real effort on the part of political parties to convince them to be part of this process. That's what I don't observe in Turkish politics as we speak. If it occurs, it doesn't occur in the opposition. It's more likely to occur in the governing party. So I'm preparing myself for a surprise. I'm about to be done. Two factors are important in voting behavior, almost everywhere, but it is so in Turkey as well. We find that short-term factors and long-term factors are important in party choice, in determining party choice. Long-term factors, by their very definition, are impossible or next to impossible to actually manipulate, change. You can't do anything about them. You take them as a given. And what are those factors? Those are ideological predispositions of your voters. What do we know about that? What we know is that over the past 2-3 decades, Turkish electorate has moved predominantly from a centrist position to a right-of-center position, which can only help the nationalist opposition, but not the CHP opposition. And most likely that creates a good environment for a conservative Islamist, no matter how you want to call them, a new Turkish right wing that is represented by the AKP. So in Turkish we have a saying, they open up their shop in a nice place. So they have their dukkan in the good place. So it sells well. So that factor of ideological predispositions being right of center is not likely to change, and it's going to help AKP. And Erdogan himself was very effective in communicating this and polarizing right after Gezi movement, rendering his whole argumentation targeting the liberals who are sleeping under the tents, drinking and boozing. Yes, the Çapulcu argument is actually very effective to polarize and strengthen your conservative right of center electorate. All right, and I think he is making a conscious effort to keep his long term committed voters intact. The short-term factors can obviously be manipulated. It depends on mostly policy evaluations, performance in different policy areas. Are they successful in their policy towards Syria? That's not very important for the time being in the minds of the Turks. The foreign policy issue is very complicated, but they see refugees, hundreds of thousands of them, and we've had bombs exploding all over the place. That evaluation might go against the government. Most important in these policy evaluations are those concerning the economy. That's why I noted at the very beginning that the events of 17th of December are having their influence over the economy, but those developments to actually sink in, you need a couple of months time. It's short term, but it's not 1, 2, 3 months short term period. It's going to take at least a year to observe what's happening in the economy. And we don't have that much time. Within 2 weeks, we will have elections. And as of today, I don't know. Again, I wish I had the data with me. But how do people evaluate the performance of their government in the economic policy area? If they are satisfied with it, then Erdogan and company will not have any trouble. Why? Because they have the long-term factors working for them. Short-term factors will then work for them, and they should have smooth sailing. However, one thing that we should keep in mind is that the younger generations are spoiled, quote-unquote. Why? Because for the last 12 years, we've had quite a comfortable economic scene. I mean, our generation would remember inflation rates in excess of 70%, 80%.
Lines.
Yes. I mean, if you are as old as we are, most of this group will not remember the lines. But, you know, back in the 70s, late 70s, you would remember getting into a line to buy a light bulb. Yes. This generation is used to buying imported stuff.
Abundance.
Yes, I mean, I had to go to an illegal underground market to buy Converse sneakers. These younger generations, I mean, they buy them from you know, their neighborhood
shopping malls.
So, but that also means that actually creates a very critical danger for AKP. Since they are spoiled, having inflation rise from 5% to 7% might not mean much for me. Because I said 7% is nothing. I'm used to 50%. But the younger generations, if they are just about to start, or if they just started working and just making the ends meet, they are not used to high inflation. And they say, oh, inflation is not risen from 5 to 7, but inflation has risen by 40%, they'll say. That's a completely different packaging of the same data. Are you with me? So 2 percentage point means nothing for me, but that 2% is 40% increase for them. So that actually, the success of AKP now turns out to work against them. And that's one danger that I see that might hurt the AKP. But Kemal told me that I should be talking about a little bit about, maybe we should leave that to...
Yeah, I think we've... All right. Yeah, let's turn to Michael.
Okay.
But let me thank Ali for really a fascinating presentation here. Some of the factors that he's been referring to, like especially turnout rates and the role of the young in electoral behavior, are factors, dare I say, somewhat gray, difficult to follow, maybe technical. But I think it was very helpful the way you framed it into the Turkish context. But I'd like to get some credit for it, because though he has sounded a bit critical of Brookings Institution because we didn't make a PowerPoint facility available, I'm trying to wean him out of PowerPoint presentations, which sometimes I think do get a bit overwhelming for the audience. And in this way, I think you got your message much clearer way. You may have had to sweat a bit.
Yes, yes. I did sweat a bit. But I mean, I had like 30 different slides. They actually saved you from my 30 slides.
I think now I'd like to turn to Michael Reynolds, who will take a different perspective on the upcoming elections. And then we can return to many different aspects and more colorful aspects of it as to what might happen in Istanbul, in Ankara and Izmir, the leading towns. Michael.
Thank you, Kemal, for inviting me to comment on Ali's paper. And let me also thank Ali for writing what really is an excellent paper, one that I commend everyone here to read. It's very clear, it's well written, and it's not very long, and it makes a number of very provocative points. And to those points I want to respond. I found the paper, by and large, persuasive. And so what I thought I would do is highlight those points that I thought were the most important ones and the ones that I found most provocative. And I'll raise a bunch of questions, and Ali can answer those questions that he chooses to. Maybe some people in the audience can follow up on them if they find them of interest. But I'm not going to expect Ali you to answer every single one of these questions. But I think it raises a number of very important and interesting questions. I think that the basic theme of the paper is that the end of the AKP's supremacy is the demise of the end of it is not imminent. That the predictions that we're going to see the fall of the AKP, that these predictions are still premature. Now, one might think, okay, we're looking at a party that's had remarkable electoral success now for over a decade. What's surprising or interesting about a paper saying, well, this is likely to continue? That doesn't sound very interesting, but of course what does make it quite interesting is this prediction comes despite the turbulence that we've seen inside of Turkish politics, particular with the Gezi protests, which has not died away. But more especially is the eruption of this corruption scandal in December that's still ongoing, that has my mind reeling, at least trying to not make sense of the corruption scandal, but I think the way that it has not knocked Erdogan and the AKP like one would assume it would. And so that's why I found that this paper, its prediction really is in many ways very counterintuitive and therefore worthwhile paying attention to. One of the most interesting things about the paper, I thought, was how it openly addresses the rift between the AKP and the Gulen or Hizmet movement. One thing that the paper suggests I thought was interesting, and I guess I'd like to press you on this, Ali, is you suggested that it was probably just debates over foreign policy that provoked the split. And I find that plausible, but I'd like you maybe to follow up. Do you really think that's the key thing, differences over foreign policy? And you cited, one, the Mavi Marmara incident, the investigation of Hakan Fidan, who is the director of appointed by Erdogan, the director of Turkish National Intelligence. And then you also have maybe policy differences over Iran. And again, I find that plausible. I'm wondering, are there other things going on inside of Turkey, other that might explain it? And foreign policy maybe is a secondary issue. And maybe, I mean, I don't know if anyone can know this other than those who are actually in the ring, so to speak, of fighting this fight. But I thought that was an interesting suggestion that it might be foreign policy. Another point I thought very interesting in the paper is you suggest that the electoral success of the AKP bodes ill for the Gulen movement, that you would see that there's a strong likelihood that the AKP will succeed in crushing the movement. I hadn't thought about that, but as you pointed out, the AKP isn't in charge of the state. That does give it a lot of resources. And that's another question, maybe if you could address, what is the likelihood that you would see, or at least as people in the audience can think about, that the AKP might succeed, or maybe I should say Erdogan, what is the likelihood that he might succeed in really crushing the Gulen movement? You, at the end of the paper, you suggested there was a pessimistic sort of scenario and an optimistic scenario with the AKP winning elections. And if I recall, with the optimistic scenario, one of the things you thought would be that they would, with the elimination of the Gulen movement, that would be seen as a triumph of openness and democracy. And part of this scenario would also see the AKP proceeding with rapprochement is not really the right word, proceeding with an opening with the Kurds, reforming, rewriting of the constitution, and attaining some sort of resolution of the Kurdish question. And I was wondering if, of course, maybe in the negative scenario where the AKP continues to take more of an authoritarian turn, would therefore the elimination of the Gulen movement be seen, would the Gulen movement then be seen as the last gasp of Turkish civil society?
Very good.
That this is a group that saw the wrongdoing inside of the state, exposed it as good patriots, and then was punished for it. So I thought that, you know, two very different reading spins that could be put on the potential demise of the Gulen movement, which is quite a prediction or possibility. One of the interesting points you made earlier on in the paper is explaining the success of the AKP. You suggested that the success of the AKP in its early years had a lot to do with its need to balance a variety of constituencies, both within the AKP, but then more importantly with also groups outside of the AKP. And that forced it to really be very careful and moderate in its policies, and that this explains success. And in part, I suppose, whether maybe the overreach that the AKP is engaged in is not so much maybe due to the strength of the AKP, but the flip side of that, which is the weakness of the opposition, which is, I always think, is really Turkey's biggest problem, has been not so much a strong AKP, but the weak opposition, which is disastrous for any democracy. And you do suggest in the paper that the CHP is becoming not simply the party of the center-left, but the center-right has moved in that direction. And I thought that was – so do you see this as likely to push the CHP to become a credible opposition, or is it simply sort of the remnants – of the center-right or joining with the remnants of the center-left, it really doesn't mean much. I suspect there's a good chance that looking from the outside, it seems that's the more likely scenario, because I think the big problem with the opposition is the lack of a credible vision for a Turkish future. So that was one question. Is the JEB likely to really become a credible opposition? Will it have a vision that can mobilize people and be convincing to the Turkish electorate? Another sort of maybe the flip side of also that question is the AKP destined to remain Erdogan's party. I've always been struck by Turkish politics, how the parties were so much a reflection of the individual who leads them. And the AKP, at least early on, was something of an exception. It was a party that emerged around an idea, had a vision, had an ideology, a platform. Now, maybe that was a mistaken vision in the beginning. At some point, it clearly did become Erdogan's party. And it is today. What moment it became is maybe a matter of discussion. It always was, or it was after 2007, really after 2011. But that's another question that the paper provoked in my mind, is what is the future of the AKP? Is it the same? Are Erdogan and the AKP synonymous? Or is there a possibility that there will be, as people talk about, Abdullah Gül maybe represents another constituency in the party? There might be other people inside of the AKP. Might that be another way out of the impasse? You suggested that you predict most likely we will see continued AKP's electoral success. However, this is a very big change. The AKP will be much weaker in its ability to implement policies. It's not going to have the free hand that it's had before. And we can see the impact, I think, right now of a paralyzed Turkey in foreign policy, particularly what's going in Syria. Another remarkable thing is everything that's going on in Ukraine. Turkey's by and large silent. A few comments have been made, but Turkey's preoccupied with its problems. And 2 years ago, I think we would have seen a great deal more, at least rhetoric, perhaps even action, with what's going on in Ukraine. But of course, besides Syria and Ukraine, there are many other issues around Turkey's borders. You know, Iraq still very unstable. The Caucasus is not exactly a stable environment. You have Cyprus, Egypt, very much in play. All these areas that Turkey was quite involved in, those areas have not settled down, and those problems have not gone away. So that's the question: the AKP's potential, if not paralysis, it may be too strong a word, but the fact that it may not be able to move as decisively inside of Turkey as it was in the past. This has implications in Turkish foreign policy, but it also has great implications, of course, for Turkish domestic policies. One of the biggest hopes that people have had for the AKP and Erdogan in particular is that this might be the party or the individual who's able to actually achieve some kind of resolution of the Kurdish question, which I think is really the biggest problem facing Turkey. And so that's would be kind of one final question. What are the implications of these elections for the possibility that Erdogan, is there any chance that he's going to be able to move on this issue? Or is he now so boxed in? This is still a very controversial question. Does he have the political capital to spare on trying to push for a resolution of the Kurdish question, which many people saw bound up with the rewriting of the Constitution, which is in turn bound up with Erdogan's aspirations to become president, et cetera. Is that out of the question now, the resolution of the Kurdish question? And those were my thoughts. And again, I really recommend people do read this paper. It's, again, well-written, it's clear, and it's not that long and very provocative in the best sense.
Yeah. Thanks, Michael. I really appreciate the long series of questions you've raised, but they are precisely the kind of questions that I think do a lot of justice to the substance of the report. But as Michael just said, Ali, don't feel obliged to address all those questions, because I know there'll be many that will be fired from the floor. Okay. So give it a crack for maybe five minutes or so, and then we'll turn to the audience.
Okay. Thank you very much, Michael. I'll start with the very last one, the Kurdish issue.
Yes.
Is obviously perhaps the defining issue for the Republic at large and its success in the future. Will Turkey be able to continue in a peaceful coexistence with the Kurds. AKP has offered, I think, the most significant attempt to resolve this this problem. We have to give that to them. I think they saw the problem as a priority. They acted on it. But I think now the plans of the Prime Minister to become the next president actually is creating counterproductive dynamics. I'm on record to suggest to him that, you know, he should forget about becoming the next president if he wants to resolve the Kurdish problem. Why? Because then the whole issue becomes one of an electoral exchange. Wait until I win the next presidential election, and the Kurds, the Kurdish leadership, basically becomes somewhat paralyzed to act in the necessary demands that is necessitated by any sensible opening. You know, if you listen to the Kurdish leadership, you see that, you know, they work without any legal framework, for instance. And this is making them very vulnerable for future rounds of negotiations. But the AKP leadership cannot deliver on that. Why? Primarily because they're afraid to lose votes in the West in a presidential election. Well, I mean, but if you don't, if you quit that aspiration of the presidency, everybody knows that, you know, AKP can get a secure vote in a general election, and you can actually continue along the lines of consensus building and include more from the opposition, invite the CHP more into the negotiations, rather than trying to get this deal of winning the presidential election with the support of the Kurdish vote. So I think this is an important consideration. And it is likely that in this local election, the HDP, BDP, West-East Division of Labor could prove itself to become a significant electoral player. And that might actually prepare them for a more meaningful role to play after having obtained a larger electoral support, let's say around 8% to 10% of the vote. Then, of course, the BDP will have more self-confidence to claim that they are the party of not only the Kurdish regions, but also for the larger country. I think if you follow what's happening in Urla, my hometown in Izmir, I mean, it's shameful to see the attacks to BDP representatives all over country. You don't observe this only in the conservative provinces, you know, Yozgat, Çorum, but you observe them in Urla, in Izmir. The slow town of Urla has these attacks. This is a challenge, but I think if we survive this challenge, I think Turkey will be a stronger entity by having the Kurdish party basically contribute to the electoral and political negotiations by taking a more active role. That can actually help control, quote-unquote, more authoritarian tendencies of the AKP as well. Because every now and then, people in Turkey came to the conclusion that the only opposition you have is the BDP's opposition. I mean, you don't get to hear other parties that much. So It's important that, you know, this local election provides a new ground for electoral engagement between not only the Kurdish parties and the AKP, but also the CHP and the Kurdish parties, and the MHP also having a role to play in this, in these links and negotiations. This is perhaps asking too much, I know, but I think it's still a possibility.
Maybe for those of you who are not deeply versed on acronyms in Turkish politics, BDP stands for Peace and Democracy Party, and it mostly represents the Kurdish electorate now. MHP is the right-wing nationalist party, and CHP is the Social Democrat Republican, the oldest party on the scene there. And maybe this would be a chance to respond very quickly to Michael's question about weak opposition,
sure,
and then we'll turn to the floor. Yeah.
Well, Turkey now has a predominant party. Predominant parties, the likes of the Turkish predominant party can be found in Japan, Liberal Democrats.
Or Italy,
the Christian Democrats. Or you go to Sweden, I think Labour Party,
Social Democrats
up there. This is a party system wherein the outcome of the election becomes not a puzzle, basically. Everybody knows who is the winner. And in successive elections, a party continues to win elections. Typically, three elections in a row is the criteria that that we look in a party system. But very rarely will you see a party system wherein a party will win three times in a row with increasing its own vote share. I mean, Maggie Thatcher had a predominant party, but she won with declining vote shares. So what AKP has accomplished is a rarity. What's important in a predominant party system, what creates this kind of repeated wins, is precisely the lack of credible opposition. Obviously, if you did have a credible opposition, then it's very difficult to score big time in elections. So almost by definition, it is necessary to have a weak opposition if you happen to have a predominant party. So will the CHP be able to succeed in raising its vote shares? I mean, this is one election where, they cannot fail to increase their elections, their electoral support, you would think. How much of a race are we talking about? I mean, the first thing I noted is that you kept saying you predicted this, you predicted that. Thank you for, but I refuse to have made any predictions. Prediction is very difficult. I would claim it's impossible for us, the academics, to do. But what we observe in different polling results, and this is public information. I mean, if you go into websites and of different newspapers, you will find, if you are as tedious as we were, you would find 75 or so polling results published over the last 6 months. All right? Not a few. Quite a number of them. And I basically summarized that in the paper. You can find the summary there in, I think, figure 2. What you see is interesting because prior to the graft allegations, AKP appears to have about 50% in like three or four different poll results that got published. After that, it loses by about 10 percentage points, but then it recovers. And now we seem to have about on average 42% reported for AKP. This is not my research. I don't find these polling results at all credible. I mean, if you are a fan of Nat Silver, he has a famous book now from Penguin. Since it's not my book, I can actually recommend that to all of you. It's a very interesting book. You know, he predicted in all 50 states for the last presidential elections in the U.S. What he does is he gives credibility scores to different polling firms. So I said, if I don't like the polling firms, then I should give credibility scores to them. So I did. I had like 18 different criteria, and the I shouldn't give the average, but it ranges between 38% to 68%. So the highest scorer in all of those 75 polls got 78% of those 18 questions. So the credibility of these polling results is very low. Nevertheless, on average, they can't miss the whole picture unless they are all sold out, basically. And I doubt that they can manipulate the results that much. I mean, we've seen, if you follow Turkish politics, we've seen, you know, Prime Minister talking to one of the newspapers editors and asking him, you know, to do something. Not him, somebody else. Anyways, don't quote me on that. But we know that at least few have been manipulated. But give one percentage, take one more from others.
The trend is
there. The trend is there. They are losing, but they're not losing that much. And that's where we are. So but these are not predictions.
One prediction that maybe we would be able to do from the trends is that as the elections approach, there might be more recordings and cassettes, etc., that might come out.
Sure.
I'd like to turn to the floor and maybe take three questions, and then we'll turn back to Ali, and hopefully we'll be able to have yet another. All right. Kathy, the microphone is coming. Two questions from the front and maybe one further behind.
Thank you very much for your interesting speech. I have two questions. Actually, you answered the second question, but what role are the non-Muslim minorities are playing in these local elections, especially in Istanbul, because even MHP, for example, have Armenian candidate. Mm-hmm. Can you say this one? And my second question was, do you think that the events of the last 2 days can really have influence on Erdogan's score? Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks. Phil, if you could just maybe mention your name, too.
I'm Phil Williams. First of all, Kamal, I want to thank you for not finding the means to get the PowerPoint up. Otherwise, Ali might have missed his own plane tonight back to Turkey.
Yes.
I have basically two questions. One is, assuming social media doesn't get shut down in the next 2 weeks, does social media provide a platform for more effective organization, potentially, than one would expect in the absence of real organization to mobilize the youth vote? Mm-hmm. And my second question is, I think we're counting out the Gulenist too much and too early. I think that part of their objection and part of the objection that they've had coming out of foreign policy, to make it real simple, is that it's bad for business. And I think that the economic and philosophical principles that underline their movement and Hizmet movement, not just the foreign policy implications of problems in Egypt or Syria, suggest to me that they have a longer and more significant role to play. I'd like you to comment on that. Thank you.
Thanks. Kathy, there's a question sort of halfway down the aisle on the right.
Hello, thank you very much for your comment. My name is Stephen Kokoris. I'm with the American Hellenic Institute. Can you please comment on Erdogan removing and reassigning police and top prosecutors in corruption investigations, yet the lack of strong political opposition makes it so he is still a candidate for presidency? And what does it say about the AKP's notion of democracy?
Okay. Ali, you have 5 questions embedded in 3. So.
Yes. I'll start with the very last one.
Majoritarianism.
Yes. I mean, the majoritarian tendencies of AKP have long been noted. I mean, we knew from almost very beginning that the party and its leadership and their notion of democracy basically is, you know, get the most votes and you'll do whatever you want. And every now and then, especially during the course of the debate concerning the presidential system, we had to be really attentive, and we couldn't believe our ears, as we say in Turkish, that, you know, Erdogan's conception of presidential system is one wherein he doesn't have to deal with the Congress, nor the Supreme Court,
nor media,
of course. Media is completely a big nuisance, and he has to do whatever it takes to get things done. So he basically doesn't have a clue as to how presidents in White House has to deal with every year with their own budgets and
every day.
Yes, I mean, you know, the balance of powers basis of the presidential system in its ideal form in the U.S. is completely missed in the mind of the AKP leadership. I mean, they would talk about the U.S. as an example of presidential system, but they'll never tell you when and why the federal system has shut down, for instance. It has its own problems, and he basically believes that these are non-existent. So these moves that you mentioned about, you know, getting rid of the prosecutors and changing laws that have been approved by a referendum, for instance, you know, these are all issues that can only comfort someone like Erdogan, basically, and you cannot defend these on the basis of, you know, solid democratic principles. Gulenists, why? First of all, I also tend to think that, you know, we have not yet seen the very last move in that
war.
Chess game. War or chess game, let's say. There might be a lot of new openings. Speculation. There might be its influences as well. But are they moved by trade worries? I'm not sure. But no matter what these worries are, I think the movement has a solid grounding in a thin layer of elites in Anatolia. I say thin because this is not a movement that has millions of followers, for instance. But this is an influential network, and it's important to observe whether they lose, and when they do lose, whether they'll go under the surface and basically hide away from the public scene. This is almost unthinkable in the way the movement is so public nowadays. But if the war ends in a very Ottoman fashion, then it will have implications for the way Turkish civil society will act in the future. So social media is effective, but not very effective, I have to say. It's effective for protest mobilization. But is it effective for, you know, getting the vote out? I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. It was a very interesting question on non-Muslims.
Yes, yeah. That's okay. next on my list.
My job is the police.
Yes. I noticed that parties are nowadays more sensitive. In the 50s, we used to have seats earmarked for Jewish and I think also for Armenian, one seat for each. This is a gentleman's agreement. It's not written in the law, but the parties would have a representative from each community. In the Özal years, we had one. Remember one Jewish MP in the parliament, a prominent businessman. But to my knowledge, we no longer have that in AKP. Maybe one, I'm not sure. In BDP, oh, but of course, yes, this the Suryani, yes. MP, yes. The BDP is very
sensitive
to minority and women representation. But in other parties, we don't have that. Now that MHP even have shown an Armenian candidate, I think it's only a good sign. But mobilizing the non-Muslim minorities have very little return for the parties. The numbers of these groups are, as you would know, it's very small. Even in Istanbul, we have less than 100,000 in total, to my knowledge. But it is important that these groups have their own representatives in councils, in municipal councils, and if they can win a municipality like in Kurtuluş, I think it will be a new era for Turkish local elections.
Mm-hmm. Let's go for another round. Kathy, yes, please. And then, yes, Kathy, there, the gentleman said, if you could just mention.
Hi, Yigal Schleifer with the EurasiaNet website. Over the last few months, I've heard more and more people expressing concerns over election fraud of some kind. And initially it sounded sort of panicked and maybe hysterical. But then looking at, you know, recent events and the government's desire to hang on to power, you know, suddenly the questions become a bit more relevant. So I was wondering, based on previous experience, how realistic are these concerns? And if they are realistic, what are, you know, what are the methods?
Yeah, very, very good question.
Yeah. Can I immediately answer?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
I thank you very much, Yigal, for this. This is one election I'm most fearful of having these rumors. In every election, we'll have these rumors, and we've had them. But in Turkish electoral tradition, we have very few and very limited fraud in elections. The famous one is 1946 election, you know, manipulated by the then single party. But after 1950, in smaller constituencies, yeah, we'll have these claims and real fraud. But the most important example I remember is from Ersin Kalaycıoğlu. Ersin always gives this example that, you know, the first thing in the morning, the muhtar will take the polling boxes to the district election committee and say, all right, here are our results. It's 9 o'clock in the morning. He says, you know, we already voted yesterday. And the results are here. So these kind of examples are a rarity in Turkey. But these rumors, again, in the social media-based rumors, every now and then I would receive a retweet from some unknown source claiming that the address-based population registry system is rigged. You have to check your name and check other people as well, which is very strange. See if unrecognized people are on your list. You know, in a neighborhood like mine in Istanbul, how would I be able to recognize everybody is unknown? It's impossible. So these rumors are dangerous if the pressure upon the media creates an environment where almost anything goes, basically, then the rumors will actually be a reality and people will react. So my fear is that on the 31st of March, if people feel that the outcome of Istanbul election is very close, very close. So up to the day of the election, the expectation is that the election result will be a part only by 1% or less. And then we see that it's 15 percentage points between the winner and the loser, the first runner-up. Then I think people will react to this. And that's the danger. And I think that can actually push people to the streets even. Mm-hmm. And that's why it should be avoided, because once we lose confidence in the election results, that will be the end of Turkish democracy as we know it, basically. Yeah.
I mean, if I may just chip in very quickly, the way I look at things at Turkish democracy right now is that there's only one pillar that is holding it, and the fact that 14 or 15 general elections have been held since 1950, and by and large, they are recognized as free and fair. If a crack occurs in that pillar, I think we risk being in serious trouble. Kathy, just here.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Yurter Özcan, CHP representative to the United States. The other day I was in a meeting and somebody asked me whether I get offended when they say opposition is not successful. And I said no, because if we're successful enough, we will not have been in opposition. We will be ruling. So constructive feedback is always appreciated. Thank you. I just want to make a few comments about what CHP is doing differently in his upcoming local elections. For the first time ever, we had over close to a million people who voted in primaries, as well as some of the surveys that we've cast as a party. And despite some of the criticism, we've placed the strongest candidates in every single location, even though some of them came from MHP, some of them were previously excluded from CHP, including in the case of Istanbul and Ankara. And I think the second most important thing that we've changed this time is basically the effort to take the party from the left side of the political spectrum to the center. Because we realize that, you know, times change. And now in today's world, not only in Turkey, in today's world, the battle is not over ideologies. The battle is over values. And I think that's something that we witnessed during Gezi movement when people from different walks of life came together in the name of democracy and freedom. And I'm off to Turkey tonight for 3 weeks, so it's going to be an exciting trip. And I'm very optimistic, actually, about how things are going to go. I know it's not going to be a very sudden change, but I think we are going to make some strides in a more democratic Turkey. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Well, if there are no more questions, I have a question for Ali that I think many of you may have in the back of your minds. Ali, could you maybe reflect a little bit on how the elections for Istanbul, Ankara, and Izmir might unfold and the significance of them, and then we'll call it a day.
Okay. The one thing that you missed for not having the PowerPoint is precisely this. It's precisely this because we didn't have enough space in the report to include province by province polling results that got published in the newspapers. So my assistant and I went over all of those and tracked them over time. What you see is in Istanbul there is a comfortable lead of about, I don't know, about 10 percentage points between the AKP and the CHP. Now, this might mean absolutely nothing because it's February, it's before Berkin's death. It's a picture, it's a snapshot that reflects at least a month or 6 weeks before our present day. So things might change, might have already changed, I don't know. But the trend, it looks like there is some comfort there. In Ankara, Gökçek seems to have a lead, but there's a slight tendency upward in both MHP and CHP in the last few polling results that got published. In İzmir, the gap between the two parties are smaller than the gap we observe in Istanbul and Ankara, which is a surprise to me, being from İzmir. I thought the CHP would have a much larger margin, but it looks like AKP has closed down the margin, but still CHP is slightly above.
Well, but Yurtar is going to Turkey tonight, so things might change.
No,
it's not reflected in the polls.
It's not yet reflected. That factor is not yet taken into account. But the problem with the opposition is that, you know, they are also competing with one another.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when MHP rises, then CHP votes go down. That's the main problem for the opposition. In Eskişehir, the gap in favor of CHP appears
solid.
But those of you who follow Turkish politics would have noticed that, you know, Prime Minister Erdogan took his time and went to Eskişehir and personally attacked the CHP candidate for being old. This is unthinkable in other parts of the world.
But he also said that he called Vladimir Putin and that the Tatars should be okay in Crimea. Eskişehir is a city that is closely associated with the Tatar population in Turkey.
Yes.
So there's something going on.
So, I mean, it's a survival game. They are using every single tool in their hands to win the elections. In Adana, the race is very close. All three parties have about the same votes, MHP, CHP, AKP. But I think in Adana or in somewhere else, one of the party candidates actually withdrawn in support of the other. Very recently, I'm not sure. So that kind of backdoor negotiations between the opposition parties might actually take place.
Mm-hmm.
In Antalya, the race is again close. Within the margin of error, but MHP seems to also increase its vote share there. In Diyarbakır, the BDP candidate, Gülten Kışanak, I think it has a very comfortable lead and it's even widening. But I have to also note here that if you are interested, you can actually go into the www.oypusulası.org, wherein we actually put a simple map for placing the parties as well as yourself on a simple map to observe which party is closer to you or which candidate is closer to you in eight cities and a generic Turkey setting. Those eight cities are Istanbul, Ankara, İzmir, Diyarbakır, Antalya, Samsun, Erzurum and Kayseri. So from one from each region, basically. And what's interesting to me was that in Ankara, the ideological content of the competition actually is pulling the candidates apart from one another, while in Diyarbakır, it's actually pushing them towards the center. And in İzmir, Antalya, in other Anatolian towns, what you observe is that the national dimension of the debate actually dominates over the local dimension, which is an oddity, because you're not electing Erdogan for your mayor in İzmir, but the debate is about the national issues more than the local issues. So these are, we have 81 races, 81 provincial races, you know, more than 900 district races. So it's a mess out there. I think this would give you an idea as to where the issue content of the competition actually shapes up.
Michael, before I end, I was wanting to ask you if you had any final comments or points to make.
Other than, again, to recommend that people read the report. That's...
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Michael. Maybe your privilege is you won't have to vote at these.
Yeah, I think I'll take that.
Well, allow me to thank Ali as well as Michael for this occasion. And thank you also. And I hope this occasion has given you a chance to have a little bit better understanding of the municipal elections coming up. Our next paper will actually be on energy. I think it's bound to be a hot topic, given again the developments in the region. And it will take place on the 28th of April. Thank you.